The moment you have all been waiting for.
Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. My guest this week is Samuel Garza Bernstein. He's author of Cesar Romero, The Joker is Wild. It's the first full biography of the dynamic debonair star best known as the Joker in the 1960s Batman TV series. Romero's career spanned more than six decades with more than 400 film and television credits alongside legends from Shirley Temple to Frank Sinatra. And Samuel reveals the man behind the suave image, a gay Latino actor who navigated Hollywood stereotypes while leaving an indelible mark on entertainment history. Cesar Romero, The Joker is Wild, is published by the University Press of Kentucky. It's available on Amazon, Barnes Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Samuel, go to SamuelGarzaBernstein.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. And Samuel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know, I love that laugh. Cesar would do that at the drop of a hat. You know, you could go up to him in an airport, on the street, in a restaurant and say, could you do the laugh? And he would happily do it. Just, he loved it.
It's so funny because when you think about it and you've written about it, I mean, how many actors or celebrities or legends would be stopped by people asking them to do something and they would be reluctant because it may come across as undignified or I'm a star, I don't have to do this. But Cesar enjoyed it immensely, obviously.
Well, I think, you know, look, I think, you know, there are moments. I mean, I know Helen Hunt was once asked for her autograph at the hospital while her uncle was dying.
Yeah, that's
and,
a good one.
She was like, no, leave me alone. I think that is absolutely, you know, yes, you should probably not ask for autographs or the Joker's laugh at hospitals.
No, agree, but outside of a hospital, maybe.
But outside of a hospital, I think it's churlish not to, you know, this is why you do this, right? To communicate to others and make them feel something. Now, if you're part of pop culture, then, you know, that it's heightened and it's, you know, it's going to come more often. But I think that, you know, he had the grace and the good humor to know that mattering to people is what he cared about. And if somebody's asking him to do that laugh, it's because he matters. And in a, you know, in a very human way.
Yeah, the audience, I think it's whoever asked him that to do that is fond of him, fond of the character he created. So it worked out fine. What inspired you? Well, actually, before that question, well, give us a little bit about your background so our viewers and listeners know a little bit about you. And then I want to ask you what inspired you to write this full biography, first full biography of Cesar Romero.
Well, I've done a little bit of everything. I moved to New York when I was 17 years old and started working in musical theater, became a writer. I've worked in theater. I've worked in film and television. And books. I continue to. After this, I have a book coming out next year about Roddy McDowall, and I'm the co-showrunner of the fourth season of a Emmy Award-winning show called After Forever that is on Amazon. And so I just have my hand in kind of a lot of different things. And when it comes to Cesar. Actually, it was my agent Lee Sobel's idea. He's the one who came to me and said, you know, nobody's ever written a book about Cesar Romero. And that shocked me. And it made me angry, you know, because I thought, well, wait a minute. He was important. Somebody should write a book about him. And so I got some ideas together and, you know, 2 days later I had a book deal and then I had to write a book.
So
I hate when that happens.
There's a certain amount of research that's available to you, but did you go, I'm sure it went above and beyond in the sense of trying to contact people that were related or connected in some way with Cesar. Can you give us an example of something like that?
Well, I certainly was able to contact people that he'd worked with, like David Selby on Falcon Crest, Other people that had worked in theater with him, like Robert Iacocca. And I was able to get in touch with people that, that people have not heard of, like producers that he'd worked with, other people that he'd worked with in business with. He died in 1994, and he was, oh my gosh, now I can't remember the math. He was 84? No, I'm very embarrassed. I'm doing the math wrong. Okay. I think he was 86. I don't know. He was old. Okay. He was in his 80s and he was old.
Okay. Fair enough.
So there aren't that many people, left alive who were, who were certainly his contemporaries. I did have a treasure trove at USC's Cinema Library, which were boxes and boxes of his scrapbooks, press clippings, some correspondence. There was a lot in there that the family had donated after his death. And so I was able to get some, some information that way too. It was especially important when it came to putting together the pieces of his early life. There wasn't a lot of newspaper coverage that was available for me to find of, a tour of Strictly Dishonorable in 1928, but there they all this information was, and it really helped a lot.
I have a feeling the answer is no to my question, but did he ever do an oral history?
No. Mm-hmm. No, he really, I'm not sure if he could have imagined the world that we live in now. I'm not sure if he could have imagined a world, for instance, where his sexuality was not a scandal, was not like, the lead story, was not like, it's just a part of who he was. And talking about his Latino roots in a real way, that wasn't something that Hollywood really did in his heyday. He used to play all kinds of different, Latino characters that were, that were Spanish or Mexican or Cuban or Italian or just anything. And, in Hollywood's view, they were all kind of the same. As was when he would play, an Indian or Pakistani or Egyptian or French or, it was all just kind of the other. And, that he was able to bring a lot of humanity and specificity to that that wasn't really necessarily in a lot of the scripts. And I think that was one of the great things that he often brought to the party.
In other words, rather than stereotypically playing a certain character, he added that humanity to the role. That's a very interesting point. I never thought about that before, but yes.
You look at him, for instance, in Wee Willie Winkie with Shirley Temple, to take like a little bit of a deep dive, mm-hmm. He plays, an Indian chieftain who's against the British Empire. Really like his compatriots kidnap her. And of course, Shirley brokers peace between the Brits and the Indians because, that would happen. But he manages to make it into this real moment where he is communicating to a child who's scared, who really does want to make things better. And suddenly the possible silliness of, the Rudyard Kipling story becomes incredibly real when this child and this man are having this real moment. Mm-hmm. And you see, first of all, you see her power. We kind of think of her as a joke now, and we don't remember how startlingly good she was when she was little and how important she was in film history. And we also see what someone like Caesar could do with, a role that could be a stereotype, the bad chieftain who like comes to his senses with the help of a little girl, But instead, he brought to it, you know, kind of a real sense of humanity.
Did you get the sense when you were researching him that he took his craft seriously, but he didn't take himself necessarily seriously? And the fact that that character we talked about in the beginning of the Joker, where he could be fun with that, and he would do that laugh for people at the airport or wherever he was, but at the same time he took his roles seriously.
Absolutely. I think you got it just right. The work was, he was incredibly present and serious about the work he was doing. Now, that doesn't mean that he was, you know, he never had an acting class. And Doris Roberts told a very funny story. They did a movie together very late in the late 80s called Simple Justice. And they played an Italian grandmother, grandfather couple who actually, spoil alert, you know, you're never going to see the movie, so I'll just spoil alert. They're the murderers, which I think is just fantastic. It was fantastic. And so they're doing this breakfast scene, and she's like, you know, she was very method, and she's like, you know, okay, so I'm going to do this and I'm going to go over here because I think she would think this, and I would do this and I would do this. And what are you going to do? And he goes, well, in the script, it says that I'm eating breakfast and reading the paper. So I'm going to eat breakfast and read the paper. And, you know, so that, you know, that was, you know, he was very like that. But right. He would always show up with a point of view. Certainly having done his work, certainly knowing his lines. I mean, that's, you know, at the bare minimum. But that he would have a real idea of what it is that he wanted to do. And, you know, my feeling is that the incredible breadth of characters that he played and all the work that he did over his years in Hollywood and his years in film and television really informed the kind of, you know, just tear the scenery apart approach that he took to the Joker, where, I mean, he just left no prisoners. You know, it was like he was taking that scenery and just chunks of it, you know. And it was just, it was kind of glorious because it was fearless.
Samuel, did you talk to any of the people that performed with him in that movie, so that in the series, so that you got feedback from people about how amazing it was to be on the set at the time he was doing it?
Well, I tell you, almost no one's left. Mm-hmm. There are some who are alive are not really in physical or emotional condition to be interviewed. But
there may have been records before, though, where they did an interview.
That's what I was going to get to. There is a very vast amount of information out there about Batman. And there are people, I credit them in the book. I don't have their names right at hand, but there are people who've written like handbooks, guidebooks, and they've done enormous research. And, you know, there's just, I relied on their work to kind of put those pieces together and go, okay, this is what it was like on set. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was very, he was a little quirky. He would go into like a place where it was like he was asleep in between setups, but he would be sort of conscious, but he would just be like, I'm preparing. And, you know, they would get the lights up, it would go, and he was just, you know, completely come to life. But it was a kind of meditation process, but it really just looked like he was sleeping on the set. And, but I mean, he really was conscious. He wasn't just sleeping.
I talked about the fact that he led a closeted life during that period of time in the beginning in Hollywood, but it didn't seem to affect either the roles he played or Hollywood's thinking about him, meaning they cast him all the time.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm not even sure. I mean, it's accurate. I'm not suggesting it isn't, but I'm not even sure that I would use the word closeted. Many people knew, But
that's a broad term. It may be not closeted, but low key. That might be
yeah,
it.
very low key, very private, I would say, very private.
Private,
I prefer that to closeted. Because I think for us, that has kind of a stigma to it. And I don't think he lived his life with a stigma attached to it. He lived a very authentic life in many ways. And the lucky part in terms of his publicity and in terms of the public perceptions of him is that he loved going out, partying and dancing, and he had the best time. So there were millions of fan magazine articles about him out with every beautiful woman that ever existed in Hollywood. If she existed in Hollywood, he danced with her somewhere, at some place, he danced with her. And, so there would be all these photographs of him doing that, obviously having a great time. And what it communicated to the public was that he was this man about town with all these beautiful women, which was, a heterosexual construct. So he didn't really have to say much or do much. He didn't, there aren't endless, kind of obfuscations in his press releases. There aren't, he never got married. He never had like a fake girlfriend like that.
Yeah, no, that's I think the dichotomy between his approach and say Rock Hudson's,
Yes.
where he wasn't purposely going out and dancing and having fun to project an image that he was heterosexual. He was going out and having fun because he wanted to go out and have
Because he
fun.
wanted to go out and have fun.
Yeah.
You see Rock Hudson and Tab Hunter and people like that in those photographs of those events, like out at a party, and they look miserable. They just look like they're like, can I take this tie off now? It wasn't their natural habitat. I mean, Tab Hunter wanted to be riding horses. He did not want to be at Hollywood premieres, whether it was like gay or straight. That was just not
Yeah,
his,
he didn't
that
mind
was
that.
not his where he was comfortable. But it was where Caesar was comfortable. And I think that made a real difference because I think the fans sensed a kind of authenticity to the whole thing.
Exactly. That's why I posed the question that way. When you look at his body of work, and this may be putting you on the spot, but let's try it. What would you say his most serious dramatic role was? Whether it was film or television, was there one that stood out to you as his biographer in this case that just showed what a great actor he was on the serious side? We know what he did with the Joker, but I'm just thinking
I
of.
think there are two things I would point to. One is rather well known and one isn't. One is Captain from Castile, which was a Tyrone Power movie, and Caesar played Cortez. And it was like, I don't know, the right moment, the right year, the right whatever. He just embodied this man in a way that made him exciting and colorful. And he was he was kind of the second lead, but you didn't care about Tyrone Power at all. You were just kind of like, well, what's that Cortez up to? Like, what's he gonna do? And he brought a sense of power and reality to this kind of, swashbuckling conquistador kind of, which really, again, was written in a little bit of a stereotypical way, but he made him sort of earthy and alive and exciting. Now, I'll contrast that with a very different role, in a movie that not many people have heard of called Deep Waters. Which wasn't that much long. It was meh, 3 years later, I think. He plays a Portuguese fisherman opposite Dana Andrews. And they basically adopt a little boy, Dean Stockwell, together. I mean, it's a little more nuanced than that. They don't, it's not like they're actually co-parents on the form, but the judge gives custody of a child to Dana Andrews with the understanding that the co-parent will be Cesar Romero. And there's something kind of, well, incredibly modern to that. And I don't want to overstate the case. There is no suggestion whatsoever that they are a gay couple. They are not a gay couple, but they are two very non-traditional parents who, who are coming together to raise a child in a very unconventional way. And he just made it seem very real that this Portuguese fisherman would kind of go, yeah, I could do that. And he established a real connection with Dean Stockwell and a real connection with Dana Andrews. And I just it really it was a, it's a fascinating movie.
I'll have to see that one. I haven't seen that one. What was the most surprising thing you discovered about Cesar Romero through your research, whether it was through the USC library or just from talking to people that knew somebody who knew somebody, that type of thing?
Well, I didn't know anything about the fact that his grandfather was the liberator of Cuba, that his grandfather was Jose Marti, and this was like the George Washington of Cuba, and there's still a statue of his grandfather in Central Park. It's like, whoa. So I had no idea about that. I didn't know that he had been wealthy as a child, that his family was incredibly wealthy, often referred to in press reports as the fourth richest Cuban family in America, which is meaningless and ridiculous, but the fourth, the third, the second, how did they know?
You're
Anyway.
wealthy, you're wealthy, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of his biography, his press biographies would say that his father lost his money in the stock market crash. And that's not accurate. His father was a sugar machinery manufacturer, and he lost all of his money in the Great Sugar Panic of 1925. Certainly, you knew about that, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, 4 years before the Great Depression, sure.
Absolutely, the sugar panic. We all know about the sugar panic. But I love the fact that were it not for the price of sugar dropping 90% in, in the span of one calendar year, Cesar Romero would have been a sugar machinery executive. We never would have heard of him. He would not have gone into show business. He would not have had to support his family. Which he did till they died. I mean, he supported his parents, his siblings, his nieces, his nephews. They were in this giant compound in Brentwood, which now would go on the market for something like $17 million.
Sure.
I looked on one of those websites and I was like, let me see if that property's still there. And it is. And they're like, what's it worth? $17 million. Okay.
Well, it showed that too. I would think that, and based on your research, he obviously had character, that he was supporting his family as and doing a lot of other things that you don't necessarily expect a typical Hollywood actor to do.
Yeah, he was absolutely a good guy. I
Yeah.
mean, there's just no way around it. He was there for his friends. He was there for, his family, and he was there for his coworkers. He was somebody, if you were struggling on the set and you were struggling with the director, you were a younger actor struggling with the director, he would kind of come in and try to help you and try to figure out, like, well, how can I make this situation better? How can I help welcome this young person into this world? How can I help? And I think that's how he looked at a lot of life. How can I help? How
Yeah,
can
that's
I make the situation better?
part of his character in the sense of
Yeah.
playing a character, but his character as a human being.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's good. When you started this adventure, which as you say, the deal got together in 2 days, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And how much lead time did they give you to complete the book?
Well, I was under contract to write a different book already. So I was like, I have to finish that book. That was a book that I had out last year about Joan Crawford, and which really looks at her cultural impact. It isn't really a biography. I mean, everyone's been there. No one needs to do that. But I felt like, nobody has really talked about, well, what did she mean to people as a famous person? Like, what did she mean to American women? And so that was interesting to me to kind of take a deep dive into that. But anyway, so I needed to finish that book, and so I think I had about a year to work on it.
Not bad. That's not bad. Could be
Maybe
worse.
under a year. But at the same time, I was moving to Portugal, so there were a couple of there were a couple of major things going on in my life.
Very, very hard to visit the USC library when you're in Portugal.
Well, I had done that work, but I was also working on the third season of a television show. And I did a stage musical too. So a lot was going on. But I like that. Like, I like it when I'm juggling a lot of things. And I think sometimes it's good because it gives a chance for some things to marinate. So I'll think about something and then I'll move on to something else and then I'll come back to it. And these ideas will sort of appear almost out of nowhere because they've been marinating in my subconscious.
Sure. Oh,
And
that's
I found that
great.
happened with the Caesar book a lot.
Before I let you go, what do you want people to take away from reading the book? Again, it's called Cesar Romero, The Joker Is Wild. It's available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and all the usual places. What would you like people to take away from reading the book?
Well, if you're a Batman fan, I think this gives you his origin story. Because when you talk about like superheroes, we talk a lot about, origin stories. Well, this is the Caesar origin story for how the first Joker came about, how he created him. What was that creative process? What was that emotional process? And it also, I think, for those of us who are interested in and who care about the history of Hollywood, the history of the entertainment business, he was an integral part of how that whole system worked. I mean, you could say that his history is the history of the entertainment business in the 20th century. And you learn a lot, I think. I learned a lot. I'll put it that way. I learned a lot about how it was for somebody who started out, was supposed to be a star this way. That didn't work out so much, so they pivoted and did this, and then that was supposed to do this, and then they pivoted and did this. He reinvented himself a lot in his lifetime. You don't last 60 years without
No.
reinvention. And I take a lot of inspiration from that, from people who understand how to work hard, reimagine themselves, and show up.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Samuel Garza Bernstein. He's author of Cesar Romero, The Joker Is Wild, published by the University Press of Kentucky and available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Samuel, go to samuelgarzabernstein.com. You can follow him on Facebook and Instagram. And Samuel, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.